This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. We're going to begin today in Israel, where this morning two Palestinian assailants stormed a synagogue in West Jerusalem, killing at least four worshippers. Three of them were Americans. The fourth was a British Israeli. Police arrived on the scene quickly and shot and killed the attackers. Today's attack follows recent unrest that included an attack on an Orthodox Israeli rabbi. He'd been advocating for Jews to have access to the Temple Mount. That's one of the holiest sites in Israel for both Jews and Muslims. That incident led to the temporary closing of the site. Ambassador Mon Rashid Erekat, chief representative of the PLO to the United States, said it's part of what he sees as the rise of religious extremism in the conflict between Palestine and Israel.
Well, I believe extremists on both sides will gain advantage. You have extremists on the Israeli side as well who want to turn this conflict into a religious conflict.
We're going to hear more from Ambassador Erekat in just a few minutes. But now we're joined by David Horovitz, editor of The Times of Israel. David, welcome.
Hi, Todd.
You just heard from Ambassador Erekat, the Palestinian ambassador to the United States, lamenting what will happen if the political and territorial conflict between Palestinians and Israelis becomes a religious one. He was warning about that. It would seem, given the news that you and I are talking about now, that that might be exactly what's happening.
Well, it's all very well for the Palestinian ambassador to lament it, but unfortunately, it's the Palestinian leadership in the last few weeks that has misrepresented the situation on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem and seems to be stoking a religious conflict.
So you're maintaining that the Palestinian leadership is using the religious aspect of this conflict and stoking it for leverage?
Well, not only me, Secretary of State Kerry, quite strikingly, spoke to Mahmoud Abbas soon after the synagogue attack and thanked him for condemning it, but made clear that the calls for days of rage, which have come from Abbas's Fatah organization, are inciting passion and consequent acts of terrorism. There's been a change of tone, a drastic radicalization of tone. Again, Hamas wants to destroy Israel. It's an Islamic organization. Terrorist organization took over Gaza, makes plain its goal. But the Palestinian Authority is supposed to be, as I say, a relatively moderate group that claims it wants to live in peace alongside Israel. That's not the tone, and that's not, and we're now unfortunately seeing some of the consequences.
That's not the tone, and don't you think in many ways, at least up until this morning, that this type of attack that Hamas would back, a religious-based attack, a murderous attack, would be a problem for the Palestinian Authority, for the PLO, which is trying to keep the violent impulses, the religious impulses of its erstwhile partner, Hamas, at bay?
We're talking about relative stances and tones here. I don't think that Mahmoud Abbas was directly involved in the synagogue attack. I don't necessarily think that he wanted it. But I certainly think there's been a change of tone. It was just a few weeks ago that he falsely accused Israel of carrying out genocide in Gaza in the summer. A few days ago, he spoke about it being unacceptable for extremists and settlers, as he put it, to contaminate the Temple Mount. Again, I would stress, and I hope maybe some Palestinians are listening, the Temple Mount is the holiest place in Judaism. It's the site of the third holiest shrine in Islam. It's holy to both peoples. Israel chose not to allow Jews to pray there. But people should not derive from that the narrative that I think Yasser Arafat used to tell the Palestinians. There was no temple in Jerusalem. By extension, there's no Jewish sovereign legitimacy in this part of the world.
David Horovitz, I need your advice before we let you go. 1994, people will remember that an Orthodox Jewish doctor named Baruch Goldstein went into a mosque in Hebron, killed 29 people with a gun before he was beaten to death, seemingly in an attempt to religify the same conflict that's going on today. Now we see more attacks, smaller scale, but in public, people praying in a synagogue. How do you think leaders should at least de-escalate the current situation? And I can't believe I'm asking for this, but at the very least, just keep it political and territorial and marginalize the religious extremists?
Well, I'm glad you asked me that, because I think the only way out of this is to complicate the Palestinian narrative. I think the Palestinians do not believe that the Jewish nation has any history in this part of the world, because I think that they're educated and their media and their spiritual leaders tell them that the Jews have no history in this part of the world. And therefore, I think if you want to de-escalate and ultimately solve this conflict, as well as bringing leaders together and trying to foster moderation among them, you have to change the diet. That's not what the Palestinians are getting, and the synagogue terrorist attack is just one terrible consequence of a mindset and an education of indoctrination to hostility against Israel and Jews.
Another dimension to an ongoing conflict that we've seen all year, political and territorial, of course, has now taken on yet another religious dimension. David Horovitz, editor of The Times of Israel, thank you.
Thank you.
We want to play for you now my interview with Man Rashid Erekat, chief Palestinian representative of the PLO to the United States. You heard a cut of him just a few minutes ago reflecting on what he calls the rise of religious extremism. I spoke to Ambassador Erekat yesterday before today's attacks in West Jerusalem. Our conversation focused mostly on the bloody year between Israelis and Palestinians. Now, Erekat's convinced a two-state solution can be worked out. He's grateful for the support from the United States, but
unless the United States shows some resolve and determination to put an end to this conflict and take a leading role in telling all the parties that they will hold them equally accountable, it will be difficult if we continue to appease Israel, if we continue to provide Israel with political cover, if we continue to tell Israel you can get unlimited financial and military support and we will provide political cover for you at the United Nations. What incentive do the Israelis have to move forward?
Ambassador Man Rashid Erekat, everyone is looking forward to the last 2 years of the Obama presidency. A lot of Palestinians had a hope for this president that he was a little more oriented to their aspirations than maybe past U.S. presidents had been. And as Palestinians and Israelis confront a new U.S. leadership, whoever that is, after 2016, Hillary Clinton, the former Secretary of State and possible Democratic candidate for president, is seen as a lot more hawkish and pro-Israeli interest than other Democrats. And Republicans writ large don't seem to be quite as friendly to the Palestinian cause.
Well, first of all, I still believe that President Obama continues to be interested in seeing a resolution to the conflict. I know deep inside he wants to see a resolution to this conflict, and he is trying. His Secretary of State, I have to, you know, to salute his efforts and his energy and his persistence, you know, to try to bring the Palestinians and the Israelis back to the negotiating table. You know, this commitment, I think, is strong. You know, the remaining 2 years should be an opportunity for the Obama administration to try to do something there with all the results of the midterm elections. But let me say something. I mean, this is a struggle by a people for independence and freedom. We have been struggling for the last 47 years to try to end the Israeli military occupation of the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, East Jerusalem, establish our own state. With all due respects, U.S. policies are not going to determine the future of our people, neither the Congress nor the future President of the United States. They can be as hawkish as they want to be. They can be as pro-Israel as they want to be. Our resolve and determination to end the Israeli occupation, to be independent, to live in freedom and dignity will not change and will not waver. And therefore, I think it is in the best interest of the United States, if they don't want to find themselves isolated with Israel in the future, to stand by the struggle of the Palestinian people for independence and freedom, while at the same time working to secure the security of all the parties in the region.
You know, on your side of the conflict as well, Prime Minister Netanyahu has been prime minister from 96 until 99 and then again in 2009. Mahmoud Abbas, president of the Palestinian Authority since 2005. I wonder if you don't think that on both sides of this conflict in Israel and Palestine, it might be time for some new blood on both sides that can bring maybe a new perspective and maybe a new identity to this conflict and maybe a settlement.
I think this is something that is inevitable. At some point in the future, you know, there will always be change. In the case of Prime Minister Netanyahu, I know it has to do with his personality, with his commitment and devotion to his ideology. Prime Minister Netanyahu does not want it to be on his book that a Palestinian state was established. I know that for sure, you know, and many Israeli friends told me the same thing, that he, although he maybe believed that there has to be a Palestinian state, he doesn't want it to be on his book, to be recorded that during his prime ministership that, you know, he you know, a Palestinian state was established. On the Palestinian side, President Abbas has repeatedly, without any question, expressed his willingness to end the conflict peacefully with Israel, to compromise with Israel, to make, you know, establish a Palestinian state. I think it has to do with the commitment to the principles that are needed to resolve this conflict more than to the personalities. It's clear that some leaders are different from others, and, you know, they don't take the pragmatic, practical approach, and they stick to ideology. But what we need here is a commitment to the principles, the foundation that is needed to resolve this conflict. Israelis know that. Palestinians know that. There will be a two-state solution, a shared Jerusalem, an agreed-upon resolution to the Palestinian refugee problem, agreed-upon security arrangements that will provide security for Israelis and Palestinians, you know, water, sharing water resources. We all know the parameters. We are, the sooner we agree, the better off everybody will be.
Ambassador Man Rashid Erekat is the chief Palestinian representative of the PLO to the United States. Well, we're not too far away from that time of year when we all give thanks. Next week, we're going to talk turkey and all the trimmings, of course. But today, our focus is about the giving part. What does it take for you to give to charity?
Laura, I'm calling from Lafayette, California. And what matters most to me is that when I give money, that the money I give goes to the people that the charity is supposed to be helping and isn't sucked up by salaries or administrative costs.
And Laura's point there about getting money to those who need it most will resonate to anyone who's ever shelled out for one of those charity records. You know, We Are the World, Do They Know It's Christmas? The list is long of those records, and we're going to have more on those charity songs in just a minute. But you might have heard that 30 years after the original and extremely successful Band-Aid movement in the UK, a supergroup has reformed, this time to help raise money to fight Ebola in West Africa. But its founder, Bob Geldof, is mad. Geldof says it's not enough for rock stars to raise money. He's calling out a number of global powers, governments, for not doing enough.
Let's look at Germany. They're number 8 in the queue. Why? They're the economic powerhouse of Europe. In fact, the Germans spent more on one football stadium for their World Cup than they're spending on people dying of Ebola. The Emirates, you know, where are they? $1 million from these massively rich oil countries? No, it's not good enough.
That's Sir Bob Geldof speaking to Sky News in the UK. So who stepped up in the fight against Ebola and who hasn't? Top of the list is the United States. So far, we've spent more than $84 million to fight Ebola and have committed even more. Only the World Bank has given more so far. Behind the United States is Canada, which has given $51 million. And only further down the list do you find countries like Germany, which is number 8, as Bob Geldof noted there. China soon will be the world's biggest economy. It's ranked 14th in the donation rankings. And when it comes to Ebola, Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg and his wife together have donated more money than the entire country of Australia. So you're not Bill Gates or Mark Zuckerberg, but what's your criteria for giving? What makes you want to be generous? Call us at 8778-MY-TAKE or find us on Twitter at The Takeaway. That's all one word, at The Takeaway. There's one of the songs that's playing everywhere you go this Christmas. That's a remake of the 1984 hit Do They Know It's Christmas? Celebrities and pop bands, and of course the guy who played Pink Floyd in The Wall, the Shaven Lunatic, all banding together to sing for the less fortunate. It's a tested tradition of England and the United States, and it's certainly nothing new. We are the world. We are the world. We are the children. Hands across America. Yeah, so the new version of Do They Know It's Christmas is focused on Ebola. It's currently number 2 on the iTunes charts and was originally performed by Bob Geldof's supergroup Band-Aid. And the song became the fastest selling all-time hit in the UK. Of course, that's when albums actually sold, when they were a thing. Laurie Majewski's been covering Band-Aid 30 for Rolling Stone. She's also interviewed several of the original Band-Aid members. She's the author of the book Mad World, An Oral History of the New Wave Artists and Songs That Define the 80s. Hi, Laurie.
Hello.
Well, take us back to 1984. I could do it because, boy, do I remember what a big deal Band-Aid was?
Oh, it was a seminal moment for me. It was a time that, yes, I loved Duran Duran with all my heart, but suddenly I found out about all these new groups, Ultravox, because, of course, Midge is Bob Geldof's partner in crime on this, and, you know, Big Country and Bananarama. But I also learned how to care from that record. I mean, you have to remember, millennials today, they know about this stuff, that volunteerism is huge in schools. For us back then, we learned that buying a record can save a life.
So this spawned lots and lots of copycats. USA for Africa was one. Farm Aid, of course, which still goes on today, I think is still pretty successful, right?
Every year. It's an annual concert.
And this became a genre that spanned lots of different causes, lots of different genres for music. I have to say, some of the efforts, I'm sorry to say, were terrible. Listen.
This sky, so serene, has felt the kiss of countless dreams. And this earth, it smells so sweet, cradles us all.
All right, now we all remember Hands Across America.
I was out there on the line in New Jersey holding hands.
Were you?
I heard there were some breaks in the desert, but otherwise we really did do that human chain. And yes, the record was pretty terrible, probably because it was session singers and a few guys from Toto, if I remember.
Yeah.
But in general, it did that effort raised $34 million. So,
what was
I mean,
the
it was
cause,
successful.
Though? I don't remember.
I think it was homelessness and the less fortunate here in this country, because, of course, USA for Africa, that was giving money to Africa along with Band-Aid, which was for the whole Ethiopian famine aid relief efforts.
Right.
And you have to remember how seminal this was, because the early 80s, it was a big party, right? I mean, you had all those escapist videos, the MTV era, Men in Makeup, and suddenly Bob Geldof comes around and he says, you know what, guys, I'm going to get you all into the studio and we're going to sing for a cause. They came in that day, those artists, they weren't paid. You know, the labels weren't paid. Even Trevor Horn from the Buggles gave the studio up for free.
Video killed the radio star. Yeah.
Exactly. And that's something they learned from, you know, they hadn't had a concert, they hadn't had a charity like this with rock stars involved since the Concert for Bangladesh, which was George Harrison's big fundraising effort back in 1971. So fast forward to 1984, when George heard that Bob was going to do this, he actually got Bob on the phone and said, you know what, I'm going to teach you all the things that you need to know, all the mistakes we made from the Concert with Bangladesh, because it was kind of a financial mess. Labels were like saying, wait a minute, we need our cut. Well, in the case of Band-Aid, and in some of the ones to follow, what was amazing was that the record labels and the business said, you know what, we're going to funnel this money to where it's supposed to go. It was pretty amazing.
They really got on board. Now, Band-Aid spawned Live Aid. There were a couple of concerts. One was in Philadelphia, of course, giant events at the time. But times have changed, Lori Majewski. Records used to sell. You can get a lot of downloads on iTunes, but everybody knows that downloads are not the moneymaker that they used to be. So is this type of effort able to make the kind of money that it used to make, even if people love One Direction and can't get enough?
You know, that's a good question, because I remember when I first heard about this, I thought, oh, gosh, how are they going to be able to match the fervor that Band-Aid was? I mean, butchers in the UK were putting the record up for sale in their windows. It was it sold. They Midge and Bob Geldof had wanted to raise a couple hundred thousand pounds. To date, they've raised $190 million.
Wow.
So that's a big deal. But how can they do it today? First of all, they've gone out there and they've said, hashtag buy the single.
Mm-hmm.
And One Direction has, getting them on board was genius. They have so much clout, so much power. One Direction, just this past summer, they had a Prizio charity fundraising campaign online where they asked their fans to give $3 each to stand up for cancer. In a few weeks, they raised $341 million. So that's One Direction. That's the power of them. Not only are they selling T-shirts and lunchboxes, but mm-hmm. they can tell their fans to go out there and support this cause. And within 4 minutes of Band-Aid, the song Band-Aid 30, debuting the other day, they raised over £1 million in downloads. That was just pre-orders.
So Bob Geldof and Band-Aid are still kind of doing it right. Is there anyone around today that's kind of trying to do this, but not, let's get their heads above water here. Let's get them on the radar screen. Anyone?
Well, you know, the interesting thing about today is you need a great hairstylist, you need a great wardrobe stylist, you also need a great charity. Whether you are authentic about it or not, it's a look. I mean, millennials, that's kind of their thing, right? So when I look at One Direction, I actually have worked with them on a couple of things, and I know that they have charity in their hearts. But even if they didn't, it's a good look for them. And I think artists today know that.
Well, you know, Lori Majewski, I have to say, before we let you go, I liked Band-Aid, I liked Hands Across America. I didn't like the song, but I liked all the stars involved with it. This was mostly my older sister was the influence on me. I remember liking Adamant. I liked Duran Duran. But I'll tell you what, I was always thrilled that Devo was never part of any of this stuff. They weren't invited, and they probably wouldn't have joined if they had been.
But they are in my book, and they are subversive, and they wouldn't be a part of this kind of thing. And, you know, maybe that's what Adele was doing when she said, I'm not going to show up. But she did give a donation, so we can't really put her down.
Say what you want about One Direction. Say what you want about Reprise Records and Band-Aid. £1 million in the first hour on downloads for the new version of Band-Aid, benefiting the victims of Ebola in West Africa. Lori Majewski has been covering Band-Aid 30 for Rolling Stone, and she's the author of Mad World and Oral History of the New Wave Artists and the Songs That Defined the 80s. Thanks, Lori.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
You know, for a lot of Southerners, the story of Union General William Tecumseh Sherman in the Civil War is a story of an unforgiving brute. The story goes that he lay waste to large swaths of the South on his march to the sea, which began in Atlanta, Georgia, 150 years ago this week. It's a version of history preserved in Gone with the Wind, of course. Listen.
Take a good look, my dear. It's a historic moment. You can tell your grandchildren how you watched the old South disappear one night. They were going to lick the Yankees in a month. The poor gallant fools.
Poor gallant fools. While there's no disputing that General Sherman's assault on Atlanta was anything short of historic, the nature of what made it so historically important has, in recent years, been undergoing somewhat of a division. This week, residents in Atlanta publicly embraced a different version of history in the form of a new historical marker put up by the Georgia Historical Society to commemorate the site where Sherman's march began. And as you can imagine, it's caused all kinds of controversy in Georgia and maybe even beyond in other places in the South. That's why we have James Cobb, the Spalding Distinguished History Professor at the University of Georgia and a former president of the Southern Historical Association. Professor, welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Very good to have you. Everyone knows that in Southern historical understanding and Southern culture that Sherman's March is a really important touchstone. Now, a bit of revisionist history, if I can call it that, is going to strike to the heart of a lot of people.
Well, particularly when you're revising popular history, that's when the sparks fly. Historians fight each other all the time, but I don't think the feelings run quite as deeply as they do when you're revising popular legend.
Well, the new marker that's going up in the place that I mentioned, I won't read the entire thing, but the important part seems to be the part that says, contrary to popular myth, Sherman's troops primarily destroyed only property used for waging war, railroads, train depots, factories, cotton gins, and warehouses. Abandoning their supply base, they lived off the land, destroying food that they could not consume. They also liberated thousands of enslaved African Americans in their path. What part of that is, as it says, contrary to popular myth in the South?
Well, popular myth in the South would have you believe that Sherman had a couple of million troops who managed to absolutely saturate all of Georgia and went to every house and stole all the silverware in addition to stealing all the livestock and burning down the barns. In fact, the troopers did forage for food, but so did the Confederates on their own population, so that's not really much of a statement. Sherman's troops did destroy agriculture, livestock forage and what have you, but their real purpose and the real focus of their activities was on destroying railroads and other production facilities that might support the continued war effort. But the whole idea of being of Georgia just being crawling with Sherman's troops, of course, was was nonsense. But it was almost a badge of honor among white Southerners to have had in your family a story of Sherman's troops coming and taking away all the family wealth, and hence everybody was penniless after the war.
Yeah, so what's the reaction been like, James Cobb? Because you're not just revising a story that, you know, textbooks, nobody really cares about. If somebody revised the story of Custer's Last Stand, I have to confess I probably wouldn't have an emotional reaction to it. But you're talking about family lore. You're talking about people's ancestry stories and sort of taking away part of the story that is behind the idea that the South will rise again.
Well, yes, exactly. You hit it. You have to think, I think, in terms of the South, really, the Southerners were working on a sense of Southern nationalism before the war, but I'm not sure they really ever got there. But they really did a bang-up job of it afterward in terms of sort of linking the war and Sherman's march to the experience of Reconstruction and the brutal treatment they were supposedly subjected to during Reconstruction, which, of course, was a very, very mild reaction compared to what might have happened to a group of rebels almost anywhere else in the world at that particular time, who were charged with being traitors as well. This sense of grievance became sort of central to Southern white identity, and it got tied up in the defense of segregation and Jim Crow, which was quintessential, it was said, to the Southern way of life, and it became such a part of the mindset that every time a Southern girl won Miss America or Alabama beat Notre Dame, it was a slap at old Billy Sherman. I mean, it was that was the kind of unity of fury and resentment in defeat that came out of this whole experience, and of course was constructed out of the whole experience Southern politicians.
Okay, and now historians like you are messing with that really well-woven and well-ingrained sense of Southern history. Part of that we're going to now call mythology, I guess. What's been the reaction to people like you, Professor Cobb?
Well, you know, I think really the reaction has come from a much narrower swath of the population than one might think. I think people who really have, the hardcore old axe grinders are definitely doing their thing. But I've been struck for several years among my undergraduate students. I teach a big freshman-sophomore class, and they don't seem all that plugged into the Civil War. And some of that is that, in this case, a lot of them are from Atlanta, which is a city of in-migrants now. I think what you're really seeing, it's a culmination of a turn after the Civil Rights Movement to really sort of recover black history and tell the story from the perspective not of the persecuted white Southerners but of the liberated black people and how they responded. But I think time is really doing more of our job for us than we will accomplish as academics.
Well, times are changing in Georgia, and they're changing across the South. And history is changing, too, at least our understanding of it. James Cobb is Spalding Distinguished History Professor at the University of Georgia. Professor Cobb, thanks for letting us in on a little bit of revisionist history.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org. Lumosity.com. Introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
Welcome back to The Takeaway, and we're going to end today's show with a man that many of you probably know, but none of you have ever met. He's a fictional creation, the invention of Pulitzer Prize-winning author Frank Ford. His name is Frank Bascom, and he first appeared in 1986 in a novel called The Sports Writer. Well, this week, the fourth book in the Frank Bascom saga is in stores. It's called Let Me Be Frank With You, and in it, Frank is now 68 years old. He's retired, volunteering with his community, and reeling from the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy. Richard Ford joins us in the studio now to talk about the full rich life of Frank Bascom and what he's learned from his most famous character over the years. Richard Ford, welcome.
Thanks a lot, Todd. You actually called me Frank Ford at the beginning of that, and I'm pleased with that because it means that my character has somehow either blended with me or become plausible.
Either that or I'm not sure if I promoted you or demoted you with the mistake, and I apologize for it because he's Frank Bascom, you're Richard Ford, and an author like you probably labors under the question for a lifetime, how much of Frank Bascom is a part of you, how much of you is a part of him. Now, I did it semantically there, but I'm sure you labor under
this. You were probably more right. As little as possible, as little as I can make Frank be like me, he is. The thing a writer exposes when he makes a fictional character or writes a novel at all is really what he's interested in. But as far as the actual views and opinions and attitudes about what he and his characters are interested in, I usually try to make Frank not like me. I mean, if I can't make my character be different from me, sometimes opposing me, sometimes scandalizing me, then I'm not imagining things freshly enough.
You've talked about the need to have some disinterest from the character and from the subject. I think you said in one article that I read that the Bic pen flows across the page. You have to be sort of disinterested and removed from the result. That must be freeing for you. But is that a measure of what you're talking about?
Well, I'm so happy to hear you use disinterest correctly. Nobody ever uses disinterested correctly.
Not non-interest.
Or right. Uninterested.
Right.
You know, language should be disinterested when you're writing fiction. You should have nothing riding on the outcome. You should be as free as you can possibly be. And if you're tethered to your own views, then I think you can't imagine things as richly and, as I said before, as freshly as you should be.
Now, why did you choose in this case? Frank Bascom has been in lots of different situations in his life, lots of backdrops. He's a former realtor. He's had kind of a rich narrative life and lots of backdrops in your work. This time you chose Hurricane Sandy.
Yeah.
I'm curious as to the choice, but also both the character and you are from Mississippi, correct? Which have had its own share of hurricanes and destruction.
And I had a good bit to do with the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans, where my wife and I went down and worked in the rebuild, some of the rebuild anyway. So I had a good storage of hurricane lore, hurricane experience. But then when Sandy came along, we were in New York at the time, and we went down there just to see what happened. And I was so affected by the aftermath. And so when you get, as a novelist, strongly affected by something, irrespective of what it is, you have to kind of pay attention to it and ask yourself, is this a call to language? Is this something that I ought to be writing about? And since it was in New Jersey, then all of the lines that came into my head were Frank Bascom lines, since that's where he putatively lives.
Well, in one of the stories in the book, it's called I'm Here. Frank actually goes down to the shore.
Correct.
To help out an old client. I won't call him a friend, but an old realty client who kind of begs for his help in assessing his property that's been razed, right? Down at the shore. And there's a big contrast there. His friend is really fighting against the tide, sort of literally and figuratively. He's angry, sort of raging at his misfortune. And Frank is there advising patience. You know, not resignation exactly, but also not that spirit that we're all fond of, which is stand up, fight, rebuild, persevere. That's not Frank's attitude, and that's not his advice.
Because I think he wants to try to give both practical advice and also advice that is faithful to his own view of things. I mean, to say to rebuild your house on the plain, you know, on the plain that will be flooded again is not necessarily good advice. Mostly what Frank's doing down there on the shore, seeing his friend Arnie, is bearing witness. He's down there sort of confirming that these things happened and confirming that this man exists by his presence there, which is really what all of these stories in this book are about. They're about some kind of giving testimony, some kind of bearing witness to the travails of others, mostly the travails having to do with the aftermath of the hurricane.
And starkly, in my view, I'll tell you something that was unexpected in reading this, was starkly unadorned with strong opinions. Now, Frank has lots of opinions about life and about people.
Yes.
But he doesn't have really, really strong opinions in these cases about the way people should react. He's confronted with situations where no opinion's needed.
That's right.
The death of loved ones or the raising of a house.
That's right. And maybe that's what bearing witness is about. Maybe when you bear witness for someone, you don't go tell them what they ought to do. Because indeed, you know, how do we know what somebody else ought to do? We're lucky to know what we ourselves should do in most urgent situations.
You've resisted in the past the conceit that Frank Bascom is an everyman.
Yes, I have.
You have, and it's tempting for readers. It's tempting for me. You know, he's an aging white guy. Things do grind his gears. He takes sort of a no-nonsense approach to some people. He doesn't like political correctness.
That's right.
He even has a list of lazy words and phrases he'd like to ban, like awesome. We're pregnant is another one. I was pleased and horrified to find out that takeaway
yes,
is takeaway is one of the words he wants banned. Which,
that's why I feel so good being here today.
Yes,
I finally know what it means.
Yeah. Well, now you do. And I'm glad that your mic flag right in front of you says that very word that Frank Bascom hates so very much.
Yeah.
So you've resisted the everyman
right.
label for him, but so many readers are tempted to apply it. Is that laziness on our part?
No, I don't know. I don't know that it's laziness on your part, but I think you sort of defined the issue quite accurately when you said he's an aging white guy. There are a lot of people in America who are not aging white guys. So so I don't think every man right from the get-go applies to Frank. I mean, novelists and characters in novels are very specifically what and only what they are. A reader can make something out of it. A reader can use a character in a way that a reader wants. But for me, when I put him down on the page, he's just this one guy living in this one town in New Jersey, looking at the world the way only he specifically does. Mm.
And is there a way, I mean, do you wish that readers could stay focused on one guy in one town with one attitude and not try to make him rabbit, not try to make him,
yeah.
you know.
Do I wish that? Well, I'm not a great wisher, Todd. I feel like if I can't make it happen myself, that there's no use. I won't tell you a very awful thing my grandmother used to say about wishing. It's not on this air. But no, I don't wish that.
Frank finds himself wishing once in a while. He wishes he didn't.
Once in a while against his own better impulses. You know, I think one of the things that the specificity of novels invite readers to do is pay attention, not generalize. Notice what's right in front of you. And not so much live in the present, but live in the facts.
Frank Ford is a novelist and short story writer. I call you Frank again.
Thank you.
I just did it again.
That's okay.
This confirms everything we've been talking about. Let's try Richard Ford, because the character, as you all know, is Frank Bascom. Boy, has it infected me, but I'm not sorry.
Me either.
The novel is Let Me Be Frank. Richard Ford, thank you so much.
Thank you, Todd.
Well, today we asked you about the types of charities you would donate to, and we do want to hear from you. Give us your take at 8778-MY-TAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. If you want to catch up on this conversation or listen back to anything you heard on the show, including the conversation with Richard Ford, not Frank Ford, you can always reach out to us at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. This is Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry, not the other way around. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.